Hey there, this is Mike Knezovich, and welcome to the latest edition of Tune Up with Mike and Monty, Thinking and Feeling Good. We're here in Chicago this morning with Dr. Monty Pavaluri on a somewhat dreary Tuesday morning. It's a little rainy and it's a little gray, but that's not going to stop us. How are you today, Monty?
I'm doing great, and I think that our topic may be quite in synchrony with the weather report you're giving, right?
It is. The darkness, the grayness. Today we're going to ruminate on rumination. I think it's a topic that I definitely have connected with because it's something that I have fought in my own life. But I think everybody does it at some point or another. It's just it's a question of whether it becomes a real problem or not. And I think it's something that most people can be familiar with, but it's worth maybe you describing it.
Oh, okay. Rumination is essentially a self-focused, persistent, repetitive, self-critical, or worrisome thought process. And, you know, this is like hamster wheel type of circular negative thinking, and it's conceptualized by some people like Baladi, Nizad, and others as toxic brooding. You're so stuck in this round and round thinking with a negative bias.
And you can't get out of it. And it feeds itself. I like that hamster wheel analogy.
Exactly.
So is it common? I mean, I feel like it's common, but it might be because I tend to do it too much.
Well, this is not uncommon, I should say. It's to some extent, everybody ruminates at some point or the other in their life with sad things happening to them or somebody upset them or something that they critically think about. But when this becomes like a persistent process, then it breeds these what we call internalizing disorders such as anxiety and depression. You know, you chew over things all the time. And it's associated very commonly where people have early adversity, where people tend to be hypervigilant, actually, hypervigilant to threat, with lots of attention paid to negative detail, and they can assume a somewhat of a passive stance to avoid conflict or aggravation of conflict, put it that way, any situations where there is controversy. So they tend to become like, you can say, passive aggressive sometimes. And in these individuals where there is a lot of stress, their cortisol is increased, and also the stress immune markers have also increased in the blood. And blood pressure, of course, we all know increased because of that physiological arousal due to stress. And also, in addition to all these changes in the body, there is also additional distress. And because of distress, again, people want to end their life sometimes in extreme situations. And also, there is certain emotion dysregulation and somewhat of a difficulty in problem solving with using your thinking processes of the brain as effectively as you want to.
I see. So everybody gets like this for short periods of time, but when you get stuck in it, then it's interesting that there are these physiological things. The cortisol is the what is it, like a hormone or something?
It's
a fight or flight stuff?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you've talked about what it is and what its impact is. It can affect everything from your blood pressure to your ability to think. But so what's going on under the hood, so to speak? What's happening in the brain itself that when this is going on?
Okay. If you think brain as a mechanistic engine that operates rumination, or generally our thinking and feeling processes, you know, there are abnormalities essentially in three brain networks, the resting state network, and then the emotional response or salience network. And then the third one is cognitive control or thinking network. So they're all interrelated.
If there's one that is central to this rumination process that we'd need to understand, what would it be?
So let me tell you, this resting state network. First, you know, it's very important to understand what this is, and this is impaired big time with rumination.
Okay.
It's also called default mode network, but I will use the word resting state because it comes more easily in our understanding to kind of visualize it. It's a bit like a fishnet anchored with a few spread out hubs in the front, back, and the side of the brain where you see a whole network at rest in any healthy individual, for example. And these brain regions or hubs are supposed to become really inactive if the brain circuitry is engaged in, say, doing any active task away from rest. But in ruminators, what happens is that there's a dynamic change from task to task negative activity, like that is rest to task positive activity, that's performance. And this change from not doing anything to doing something is absent. And all these regions or hubs that kind of hold the fishnet together, the brain circuitry together at rest, actually become so aroused and activated during the toxic brooding, you know? So especially the anterior front parts of the brain called medial prefrontal cortex and subgenual anterior cingulate cortex are all hyperactive in these people who are supposed to be ruminating or depressed and ruminating or anxious and ruminating relative to those of healthy individuals.
So in a healthy situation, I'm sitting here and I'm just, or maybe I'm on the train, I'm coming to your place.
Yeah.
And so this network should be kind of quiet under those circumstances until we sit down to do this task, the podcast. But if I'm ruminating, these things are firing off and making me nervous and the whole time.
Exactly. You got this, Mike.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're a good teacher.
Oh, thanks.
That's okay. So that's going on all the time. So this withdrawal, I'm interested in it because, I mean, it's obviously creating discomfort for the person. So the way they deal with it is they go into their own shell. They don't engage. Is that their mechanism?
Exactly. So these individuals who are ruminating a lot or depressed, they withdraw a lot, and then what happens is that the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex, which is essentially the front lower lateral part of the brain, okay? So the subgenual cingulate cortex is hyperactive in these individuals with rumination, and behavioral withdrawal essentially is represented by this region, which is conserving the energy by being overactive. It says, okay, you know, you retreat to safety, you conserve all your energy, and therefore stay put, you know.
I see.
That is what is happening. And you know what? One more thing I want to say is, mm-hmm. as opposed to this behavioral withdrawal, some people actually, if they're energetic and active, then dorsal part or the top part of that region or anterior cingulate is active, but it's the lower part that is overactive when you're withdrawing. And also, altogether, if you look at all the way at the back of the brain, there is a posterior cingulate cortex that is corresponding to this anterior cingulate. And that posterior cingulate cortex is active in also as a part of resting state network in these ruminators, where they're thinking about duties, obligations, or they're thinking about any self-frame of what happened to them in their autobiography when they're really thinking about a certain time and situation that happened, and that PCC is active. And this is reported by Johnson and his colleagues in 2009. And these are all reported findings of quite significant nature.
It's so interesting that this is just not really an important thing, just something that strikes me as interesting, that in an individual that's withdrawn and maybe kind of ruminating, and that it's a function of the brain being overactive. So the outside person is underactive and the inside person
exactly
is overactive.
You know what? That's exactly what I was thinking when I was just about to do this podcast. wow, these are the people, like the duck, you know, like look like they're quiet on the outside, and then their feet are really fast and working. In fact, you know, all their cortisol and all their immune markers, blood pressure, hyperarousal, vigilance, you know, all these are just super active. And these are all like hyped up, also reflected in brain resting state network.
Yeah, it's not pleasant, don't get me wrong, but it is really interesting.
Yeah, sad.
When people, we said earlier, probably everybody has like a bout with this kind of thing. But yes. When it's a problem, are these people always in this state, or are they constantly sort of fighting this state?
To some extent, they may be like this, fighting a lot more than less. Mm-hmm. And these are obviously aggravated in the state of depression or anxiety.
Okay.
But however, in between the episodes, these individuals who tend to ruminate tend to be a little more reactive, with high basal reactivity. And, you know,
okay. And so what does that mean? Just what does that mean? High basal reactivity.
You know, people who react very quickly to negative things.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Okay.
And they get hyper about negative bias, and they kind of wound up very quickly. Those individuals, it's a bit like a trait marker, and amygdala seems to be extremely overactive in these individuals in between the episodes of depression, with or without rumination, they tend to be. By the way, Mike, all these rumination factors were correlated with rumination behavioral scales completed by a lot of research subjects. So I want you to know that.
So there's a lot of data behind all of this.
Yeah. It's not just that,
yeah. You had mentioned that besides the sort of blood pressure and the physiological effects, that it can affect your cognitive abilities. How does that work?
You know, I always talk about it in the previous podcast as well, where the thinking part of the brain is dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That is where exactly the Mickey Mouse ears are on your brain, you know, like underneath the Mickey Mouse ears. That part of the brain is top lateral or side part of the prefrontal or front part of the brain. So this dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is connected to medial prefrontal cortex, okay? So when you cut the brain from front to the back, slice it up, then the medial wall of both slices of the brain in the front is the medial prefrontal cortex that is very involved in resting state network, the anterior midline structures, in other words, or the front part of the structures. So that is not necessarily very directly connected to this dorsolateral or thinking part of the brain, you know, the Mickey Mouse part, ear area. You know, what is interesting is, see, I told you about this amygdala, right?
Yeah.
The one that is overactive, and that is directly connected to dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, and that's directly connected to medial prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
So that acts almost like a middleman or a hub that is kind of intrudes into this ruminators and make you react and steal away the thinking abilities by this emotional over-response.
I see.
You know, so that's why when you're emotionally overreactive and you're also ruminating, then there is less resources allocated to the thinking part of the brain. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
That is exactly what people call as amygdala hijack when you're thinking.
Okay.
And this is greater in ruminators in between the episodes.
So
as well.
In simple terms, it's using sort of neural resources that could be used to think logically, but taking them up with an emotional and not necessarily logical reaction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You got this.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So If I'm stuck with this, I'm going to go back to one thing. When you said something about early, this can be caused by sort of early experience that made you hypervigilant. That could be some kind of trauma when you're a kid, or what?
You could have trauma, or you may be sort of genetically depressed and, tend to ruminate, or somewhat of an anxious person born with anxiety with genetic reasons.
I see.
It could be any number of biopsychosocial reasons that could trigger.
Now, all right, so for whatever the reason, I mean, I'm sure that's, what do you do about it? What are the treatment options?
You know, apart from, I mean, you know, obviously there are kind of a couple of immediate things one thinks of other than kind of like avoiding all these toxic triggers externally or people who kind of bother you too much, you know.
Yeah, you kind of don't get away from.
Yeah, you get away from, especially if you can't fix it. You know what I mean? I don't want you to say, hey, withdraw from all these difficult people. But what we mean to say is it's hard to kind of like fix a lot of stuff, you know, and that's life for us, right?
Yeah.
And so sometimes keeping boundaries and or minimizing some of the negativity is really important, right? And, I mean, from treatment point of view, there is pharmacotherapy, you know, like there is medication to reduce depression and anxiety, somewhat what we call serotonin reuptake inhibitors, for example. And when you give those, like citalopram or escitalopram, which is long-acting citalopram, all these medicines DiSimplico and Chan and other people have done a lot of research on this, have shown that remember I told you about subgenular anterior cingulate that is hyperactive? That is decreased in its activity with these medications.
I see. So it just turns the volume down on the activity for these things. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Turns the volume down. And also, they're, you know, in treatment-resistant depression, where they haven't gotten better to any of these medications, for example, or treatments that are like mindfulness therapy and stuff. By the way, the mindfulness therapy training also reduces rumination. And this is research by Farb and his colleagues in 2011 have published that, have also shown that mindfulness reduces rumination. And then the treatment-resistant ones are the ones I was going to say. There is some research evidence that deep brain stimulation has helped these individuals also to reduce subgenular anterior cingulate activity, but that's not really available on a regular basis for a lot of people at this current time.
I'm going to cycle back the mindfulness thing. That's the sort of meditation, the various breathing exercises. I mean, is that what that...
Yeah, mindfulness, you know, we'll talk on the coming episodes about mindfulness in more detail. But what I want to say here is mindfulness is something like awareness of your surroundings without judgment.
Okay.
And being able to focus and not always think about yourself and chew over things, but try and see what is going on. Observation with extreme focus, you know?
Yep.
It's not just letting go, but it's letting go, but with some discipline, you're kind of observing everything around you.
Yeah, it's letting go, but it's not disappearing.
Awareness.
And then this other thing, I've seen a couple things about, you mentioned deep brain stimulation, and I have a very meager understanding of it, but I keep seeing a little... article here, article there. What is it?
Oh, deep brain stimulation is actually one of my mentors, Helen Mayberg, is the pioneer in... applying deep brain stimulation for depression, treatment-resistant depression. It's a neurosurgical procedure introduced in 87, and it involves actually implantation of a medical device called neurostimulator, sometimes referred to as brain pacemaker. It sends electrical impulses through these electrodes that are implanted in specific targets or brain nuclei. I mean, for example, in depression, it's in subgenular anterior cingulate, for example. It is shown to be effective in a few patients. So it seems to be a promising treatment for future, actually.
But it's new and it's not commonly available.
Yeah, I mean, it's onerous. And it's also found to be useful in obsessive compulsive disorder as well, although the dramatic improvement is only in half of the subjects and not in everybody. So it's hard to decipher the finality of its use. But in OCD, they place it in a place called ventral striatum or nucleus accumbens in basal ganglia. So, I mean, it depends on the disorder and the area that is implicated in that disorder where it's stimulated.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty fascinating. I never heard the term brain pacemaker before, but it actually helps understand it immediately.
I know.
It's a great term. I think we have covered it. I've learned a lot, like I always do in these sessions. So thank you, Dr. Pavaluri.
Thanks so much, Mike, for engaging and, you know, having a fun discussion of an incredibly serious and impactful topic.
It is serious, but
I'm grateful we can talk about it. And I also feel hopeful that there is a treatment for all these problems and we can make a difference. But the first thing is you also have to understand what's going on. And now there's so much available on how the brain operates, and it's exciting to decode that for everybody.
Yeah, it is an exciting time, and it just seems like we're learning more and more. All right, that'll do it for today's edition. I'll see you, Doctor.
Thank you so much.